Centerville, Iowa is easy to overlook. It's a small town just a few miles north of the Missouri border, but it's a community that is rich in fascinating history. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Historian Enfys McMurray has dug deep to uncover stories that could easily have been lost to history. She is the author of Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. We'll talk about the early abolitionist settlers of the community, its role in the Underground Railroad. Later, it became the seat of the KKK in Iowa, but residents eventually rose up and threw the Klan out. Those stories and more this hour. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Centerville, Iowa is the county seat of Appanoose County. The center of town is just 10 miles north of the Missouri border. And right now it's home to about 5,500 people. The population of the town has never exceeded 9,000, but Centerville is rich in history and stories, and that history captured the heart and imagination of Enfys McMurray when she was teaching at Indian Hills Community College in Centerville. She has written a tome about this history. It's called Centerville, a Mid-American Saga, and she's with me today. Hello, Enfys.
Hello, Charity. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, and I have a feeling that people will pick up pretty quickly on the fact that you are not from Iowa originally.
No.
What brought you to Centerville?
I married an American who was a very good physicist. Part of his science is currently on Curiosity on Mars. But the marriage didn't last. But in the interval of the marriage being in existence, he kept saying that he wanted to move back to Iowa. And in particular, he was teaching at the University of Alberta in Canada. And he particularly said that he wanted to look for a job somewhere. So he started teaching at Indian Hills Community College, both on the Centerville and the Ottumwa campus. And sooner or later, Dr. Jean Gardner, who's pretty well known in all the community college circles throughout the state of Iowa and the Midwest, he was misguided enough to hire me as an instructor there. And it was 23 years of incredible experience, just wonderful.
Well, I can imagine that that was a little bit of a culture shock for you, being in Centerville. What was it that first captured your imagination and made you really want to research the history of the community?
It was many years after I was teaching there when Lottie Wilson, one of the administrators, came and asked me to do a historic walk around Centerville. Now, I said to her, when did the town start? Because if you're an English teacher, you're grading papers all weekend, right? So I said, when did this town start? She said, 1846. Now, the town, which is my hometown in Wales, predates the Romans by 2,000 years. So with true European snobbery, I thought, well, that bit of research will take me 5 minutes. I said, yes, and then was so astounded at every page I was turning to find out what was happening in Centerville, that I was sort of lost for a while until a good colleague of my husband's at the University of Alberta said, go and read The Bridge on the Drina by Ivo Andrich, which won a Nobel Prize, goodness knows how many years ago. And what Ivo Andrich does is take the bridge over the river Drina in Eastern Europe and starts incorporating what was happening with the various people on that bridge and connecting it to history. And that's when I realized that Centerville's history is almost a perfect microcosm of American history, at least for the 100 years that I covered it. And maybe I should narrow it as well and say it's a perfect microcosm of mid-American history from 1846 up until 1946 when the men were coming home from the Second World War.
Well, let's go back almost to the beginning, to the 1840s and 1850s, when people started coming to live in Centerville. Where did the original settlers come from?
Well, a lot of them came from the east at first, Indiana, Ohio. Some of them came up the Mississippi. It isn't until later, with the discovery of coal, which happens a couple of years after the Civil War, that the tremendous character of Centerville changed. And to me, the character then became so incredibly diverse. Now, I know this was happening in all the cities in North America, but not in a community the size that never was bigger than 8,600. This, to me, is what makes Centerville significant in the whole country.
Well, and yes, there were times when you document there were immigrants from 40 different countries living in Centerville?
Actually, over 40.
Over 40 countries.
It was the 1920 census when I read that and could see the diversity. Now, every country in Northern and Southern Europe were represented. You know, all the usual ones, England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, France, the whole lot. But then I began to perceive the enormous amount of Italians and Sicilians who came in. And then if we move into Eastern Europe, there were Turks in town. There were Syrians. There were people from Lebanon. There were Jews that came in to escape the pogroms in Poland and Russia. There were eventually 60 Jewish families with their own synagogue living in Centerville. And as they all poured into Centerville, there were Mexicans that came from Mexico. There was at least one Chinese family that emigrated in. We've got Canadians coming south and African Americans trying to escape the terrible conditions in the south coming north. And it was really the coal mines that attracted them.
And that history, although, as you say, it's a microcosm of what was happening in so many cities in the United States and in the middle of America. But that is not typical for towns in Iowa. I mean, so many towns in Iowa have these strong ethnic identities because a lot of people from Norway or a lot of people from Denmark would settle in these communities. Centerville was really, in many ways, one of a kind.
That's exactly my point. And that is what then encouraged me to give up the job I loved at Indian Hills. And I bought my own microfilm reader printer. You can imagine what that cost, right? And I stayed home for the next 10 and a half years and read every newspaper in the town, every book I could get hold of that referred to it. Sometimes they were unpublished books, but they were valuable. There were even family records. The whole community just opened up their arms and told me absolutely anything I wanted to know. And then, of course, when I reached the Second World War, which has got tremendous significance for me, because my family would not have survived the Nazis if they'd gone into Great Britain. My father would have been pretty outspoken. And when I found that those first Americans that I remembered as a child, they were coming down the streets in my hometown, and we kids absolutely adored them because we would run to where these huge army truck convoys had to slow to come into the town, and we'd yell on top of our voices, you see, got any gum chum? And they'd throw out Hershey bars and Wrigley's, and that was my first experience of Americans. And when I found a lot of those veterans were still alive, I couldn't wait to interview them. And I was honored that they chose to tell me their stories.
And now, in this book, you have written more than 500 pages of history of Centerville. So, of course, in this hour, we're only going to hit some of the highlights. But let's go back before the town became so incredibly diverse.
Right.
It became a place that attracted a number of abolitionists. How did that happen?
Well, if you look at the map, you can see that Appanoose County is the fourth county west from the Mississippi, and it's right on the border. Iowa shares a 252-mile border with the state of Missouri. 32 of those miles are Appanoose County. And as you said in the introduction, that's 10 miles from the center of Centerville. So I began to have a hunch that there could have been an underground railroad. And there is one distinctive place, that a man by the name of J.H.B. Armstrong. We know that he was, but my instinct was there had to be more. And then I read that when the Republican Party began in Ripon, Wisconsin, the whole purpose of the people who joined and called themselves Republican. By the way, the governor in Iowa was the first Republican governor in the whole nation. And they joined in order to stop slavery going into Kansas and into Nebraska. So I knew that anybody that had that word Republican attached to them in the 1850s and the 1860s, they had to be abolitionists. And then by absolute sheer luck, I was sitting in the courthouse trying to find various ancient records, and this huge tome literally fell open. And there at the top of the page were the words, "The Appanoose Republican Newspaper." And there were 39 stockholders of that newspaper. So in my inadequate way, I started trying to track their land, and I found that the 39, one by one, went into the first courthouse on Appanoose in Centerville Square, which was then a log cabin courthouse, and they were buying land and more land and more land. J.H.B. Armstrong eventually owned 2,000 acres, and the land was carefully positioned so that each purchase appears to, and I'm 99.9% sure of this, the land was contiguous. It was touching the next piece of land so that there was a safe path from the Missouri border up to Centerville, up again to Hyattsville, which is just south of Moravia, and then east through Unionville and east again into Davis County, where they joined up with other abolitionists helping African Americans escape. They then went north to Eddyville and then on north to the safety of Canada.
And there was an active effort on the part of the abolitionists who first came to Centerville and founded the little town of Cincinnati to recruit other abolitionists to come to the area. I love the phrase that was used in one of these recruiting ads, really, saying Appanoose County is the most beautiful, richest, and healthiest place in the Western world.
Yes, and I tracked that microfilm, down from Yale University. And Yale University had copies of the newspaper in which that advertisement appeared. And everyone reading that newspaper in the East would have been abolitionists anyway. So those key words describing the beauty of Appanoose County was enough to attract them to come. A lot of them were already in Lee County and some in Van Buren County, which are also along the border. In fact, I'm absolutely convinced that the whole southern border of Iowa has got to have the most incredible Underground Railroad stories that are involved somehow or other.
Well, and we did talk about a number of those recently on
yes.
Talk of Iowa. We're going to have to take a short break,
okay.
Enfys. We'll be back in just a moment. Today, I'm talking with Enfys McMurray. She is the author of Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. She taught for many years at Indian Hills Community College in Centerville and then spent more than a decade digging into the history of this remarkable community and has put it together in this book. We'll continue to hit some of the highlights this hour on Talk of Iowa, and you are welcome to join our conversation, particularly if you have ties to Centerville and stories to share. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are exploring the history of a small town with many fascinating stories. Enfys McMurray is the author of the new book, Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. Centerville, of course, in southern Iowa, just 10 miles north of the Missouri border. And we were talking about its place in the Underground Railroad, the fact that many abolitionists came and settled in and near Centerville to do their work trying to help those who were seeking freedom in the north. And Enfys, as I said, there's so many great stories. We have to move quite quickly along. I know in 1860, the community voted to build a splendid courthouse in Centerville, but that had to wait until after the Civil War. And it is a beautiful, beautiful courthouse. Let's talk about some of the interesting characters of the town. And one of them is General Francis Marion Drake. He was a general in the Civil War. Tell me a little bit about him.
Yes, he grew up actually in Davis County and then switched over into Appanoose County. He went into the Civil War. He was an outstanding general. He was very badly injured at the Battle of Mark's Mill. He came back to Appanoose County, and around the square, I think I counted about 12 businesses that he was actively involved in. His wife died when he was still in his 50s. They had about 5 children, and I'm fascinated with what has happened, particularly to one of those. But anyway, Francis Marion Drake ran. He called himself a Republican, and he actually made the statement, "I was very proud that the first vote I ever made was for Fremont." Now, because I'm British, you must remember I was a little hazy who Fremont was, but Fremont was the first Republican nominee for president from the Republican Party. And he carried Iowa, by the way. He did not carry Appanoose County. Appanoose County had 38% of its citizens were Southerners. They saw nothing wrong with slavery. But after Fremont, of course, Lincoln then got the next presidential nod from the Republican Party, and the rest of that everyone knows. I found then that Francis Marion Drake in the 1890s was asked by the state Republican Party to run as governor. He did. He was very successful in the terms that he carried out, very focused on education. The Historical Society was really started. The building was started with his influence. He was a very proactive governor. The problem was that he was not in good health. Diabetes had set in as well. And then his injury from Mark's Mill, in which he had almost died. He was giving a speech on the courthouse square up here in Des Moines, and he fell in a rainstorm. That dislodged his hip, and he knew then he could only do one term as governor.
And even before he was governor, he funded a university that, of
course,
many of us have heard of, which is Drake University.
Drake University. He gave an enormous amount of money, and all the way through his career, he was giving enormous grants of money to Drake University, which holds his name. And, you know, by sheer chance, one of his great-grandchildren, I've lost count of the greats, came through Centerville about, 2 months ago. And by absolute accident, some of us heard about it. So we, all of us fascinated by this bit of history, poured in and found this wonderful couple from San Diego. And they were very impressed by how respectful we are of Francis Marion Drake. And yes, he continued all his life giving money, huge money, to Drake University.
Well, and I was amazed in reading about him. I mean, not only was he our governor, and he wasn't the founder of Drake University, but in many ways he was, because without his largesse, it wouldn't have continued to become what it is today. But there are so many marks that he put on our landscape that still continue to be icons in Iowa, like the statue honoring the soldiers of the Civil War.
Yes. With many of his colleagues in the Civil War from Appanoose County have got their names and their medallions on that monument.
Now, we talked earlier about the incredible diversity that came to be in Centerville. And again, once coal mining became a big industry there, that attracted immigrants from all over the place, more than 40 countries represented in Centerville. Although it didn't become a large town, I mean, clearly there was a lot happening.
Oh, enormous amount. And there was a lot of conflict between all the groups coming in. For example, when the Germans, just before the First World War, when the Germans started marching into Belgium, then there were, I think, about 80 Belgians in the town, first-generation Belgians. They hadn't even converted to become Americans. So they were going into the Iwegian office and, you know, demanding to get information from the telephone as to what was happening from their families as the messages were coming in from the different news sources around the world. Then the French, of course, became very upset when the Germans, the Nazis is the Second World War, when the Germans started marching into France. And so it went. And throughout the First World War, as the Italians were dying in enormous numbers, representatives were sent to Santi Mellini, who was the Italian representative on Centerville Square, and he was asked to name all the Italians who had not become United States citizens and send them back because Italy was running out of money. And the British sent a colonel into Centerville, and he started tracking the British that hadn't become citizens and taking them home at the same time.
Wow. Now, of course, things were happening in the United States as well. With the turn of the century, of course, came electricity and came the automobile, and life changed so dramatically for everyone. Let's talk a little bit about Prohibition. And there had been quite a bit of controversy over alcohol and the women's Christian temperance community before Prohibition yes. came to be. There had been a lot of conflict in Centerville already before Prohibition, right?
Oh, absolutely, because the Greeks, the Turks, the Croatians, the Sicilians, a glass of wine was a normal part of their daily enjoyment. So when Prohibition came in, it thrust so many perfectly decent, good people to break the law. And Prohibition forced some of them, went even further, and became associated with Al Capone. And Al Capone made regular trips into Centerville. And so did that very nasty man who was one of his henchmen, Fred Burke, who did the shooting at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago. Fred Burke eventually came to Centerville hiding from the FBI and changed his name to Richard F. White, went into the courthouse in the center of Centerville Square, took out a marriage certificate and married a girl called Bonnie Porter in Centerville. She later claimed she didn't know his history. Other people I've interviewed say they suspect she did. So with Prohibition then, so many people were now making illegal stills that right across Iowa, the average number of arrests for illegal stills was between about 20 and 25. In Appanoose County, it was 63.
Wow.
So these people were not about to give up their way of life, you know.
Right. Well, and they must have been providing alcohol to many others in Iowa who also didn't want to give that
they
up.
They were. Des Moines police complained, you know, how much of this liquor is coming up from Appanoose County. And they sent it, of course, through to Chicago via the Al Capone network. And one gentleman appeared in court before a judge after he'd been arrested in Centerville. And he said, look, I can sell Appanoose liquor, which was called, it looks like grappy as it's written down, but local people have told me it's pronounced grappa. And he said, I can sell 1 gallon of grappa in New York City where there's great demand for $40 a gallon. Now imagine the economic incentive in that time of the year, age in the early 1920s is perfectly obvious.
Absolutely. Now, something else that happened in Centerville in the early 1920s is that the Ku Klux Klan started to organize in the community. What were the roots of that?
Well, the roots, the KKK always give another reason for their entry. Crime had broken out. And it was clear across the country. It wasn't just in Appanoose County, but right at the end of the First World War, a lot of sociologists would argue that law and order does tend to break down. And it certainly was breaking down in Appanoose County. In fact, at one stage, Centerville was called the murder capital of Iowa. So the Ku Klux Klan used that as an excuse, and one of their main newspapers out of Arkansas put a huge headline in the paper, and the headline was, Centerville Needs Klan. And they began to arrive. They arrived under G.N. McDonald, was the first leader of the Ku Klux Klan. He drove onto Centerville Square in a black car and got out of the car. He was rather tall. He was Texan. He made very obvious pulling wads of notes out of his pocket and turning them over. And then they appeared to become quite quiet for a couple of months. So the editor of the Iowegian, Jesse Beck, who was automatically opposed to the Klan, didn't quite know what they were doing. But what they found out was within a few months they had organized. And their main process of organizing is to get rid of Democratic appeals against them. They were, for example, had taken over the Democratic Party and then the Republican Party. And remember, they were still civil rights oriented in that day, even then. They were sitting in a room in Centerville with about 30 members there, choosing delegates to go to the state Republican meeting. And the door opens and 34 to 50 people they'd never seen in their lives before walked in, sat down, proceeded to overturn all the votes, declare themselves as being devout Republicans, which of course they weren't, and choosing their own delegates. So now there was no legitimate Democratic way for the people of Appanoose County to rise up against these people.
Well, and the Klan was quite generous with donations, not just with political parties, but with churches as well.
They were. And I'm sorry to say that every Protestant church in Appanoose County, every leader was either went over actively to the Ku Klux Klan, believing it was going to get rid of crime. I mean, that's the kindest way I can put on what their decision was. But a whole lot more were compromised because they had received these big packets of money that they felt they couldn't speak out against the Ku Klux Klan, which I suspect was their aim in the first place. But people did start fighting back as soon as they understood what their agenda was.
Well, and tell me, what did the Klan do? Obviously, they took over politically in the community. Was there violence?
There was violence. In fact, we're pretty lucky that no one was killed. There was a shootout on 12th Street where their office was. They had control of three newspapers in Appanoose County, and one of those was just off Centerville Square on 12th Street. And the name of the newspaper was the Southern Iowa American. And I've read all those on microfilm as well as the Iowegian to see the clash between the two. Yes, there was violence. There was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of arguing. There was a gunshot, and it's very lucky that the person wasn't killed. But we can't actually ascribe a death to what happened in Appanoose County, but it came close as the people of the town began to realize what had happened, that economy was in free fall. Everyone, families were split. They were turning against each other. It was a terrible time. And the leader of the Iowegian, Jesse M. Beck, he was the editor. He'd opposed him from the beginning. And so had other leading characters in the town. And they had a secret meeting. And they decided with the coming up of the next city council election, when they didn't have control over the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, they met in secret, five of them, in a doctor's office. And they decided to start contacting people by word of mouth that they knew opposed the Klan. And this was the turning point. They set up a secret party and they called it the Lincoln League. They knew if there was any word that leaked out that they were going to have a general meeting, that the Ku Klux Klan would immediately storm it like they had with the Democratic and the Republican Party. So they put out the word by mouth that they were going to have a public meeting. And when the names of the people going to run for public office on the Lincoln Party, that they were going to represent the Lincoln Party for the local city election, then they waited until 10 minutes before the nominations closed in the city hall. And they walked in and they put down the people who the town knew then would oppose the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, the whole story of what Jesse Beck had to tolerate, what all the people had to tolerate in that area, the shopkeepers, the undertakers, everybody. Actually, people have told me it would make a Steven Spielberg movie, but I don't expect he's going to walk into Centerville any day soon. Anyway, that election in May of 1925 was the biggest turnout of any election in anything in Appanoose County, and by a vote of between 500 and 900 at all the precincts in Appanoose County, the Ku Klux Klan was defeated.
So the Klan was defeated, but the people behind this organization were still in the community. What happened?
Yes, it remained very divided. There were rumors, about this grocery store. People wouldn't go to that grocery store because he was either on the side of the Ku Klux Klan, he was opposed to the Ku Klux Klan. And that's what the Klan did. It created such terrible divisions between families, between the community, that it took years to recover, to get over it. And we talk about our divided politics now. Oh, my goodness, people should read history and go back and read what happened.
As time moved on, did the people who had been silenced by that election in many ways, did they tend to leave the community?
A lot of them did. A lot of them didn't. The Jews that were in town in their local synagogue, they now had new worries as Hitler was coming to power. Right. And people who are bigots are always there. I'm sure there's a few around in Abnoos County. They're not the major lot of people. Major lot of people are wonderful. There's a few bigots still around there. And every so often the mask slips and you can see what they really feel about racial issues.
As there are everywhere.
Everywhere across the country.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Enfys McMurray. She is the author of Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. This hour we're talking about the fascinating history of this little town in southern Iowa. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you have Centerville ties and stories you'd like to share, give us a call or questions for Enfys. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour I'm talking with historian Enfys McMurray. She's the author of Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPR Talk. And Enfys, we have an email question for you. This is from Reno in Urbandale. He says, I'm from Mystic, and my wife had Enfys as a teacher. I wanted to ask her if she heard the rumor that Drake University was originally going to be in Centerville.
Yes, I'm delighted I told. I had a wonderful career as a teacher, just loved the students. I could never find the least proof of that statement. Now, neither could Gary Craver, who's one of the big historians. We'd both heard of this story because it's usually put around Centerville quite openly. We never, ever could find any proof that that's what Governor Drake had in mind. I don't know how that story got started even.
Well, and the university had started, was it in Ottumwa, and then was moved to Des Moines?
Yes. I'm not sure it was Ottumwa. Okay. I think it could have been, maybe you're right, it was Ottumwa. I don't remember. But I know that that is where Drake started. And the leaders of Drake came to Centerville and asked Drake, would he make a contribution to that college? He did. But it moved to Des Moines, and he had given so much money and was continuing to be so supportive with huge amount of money that it became Drake University in Des Moines.
Reno also says that he'd heard a rumor that Chrysler Motor Company was rumored to start in Centerville.
No.
No,
that's
okay.
I've made a note of that, Reno, right? And I will go and look that up. But no, I haven't found it.
All right. Sherry is on the line from Davenport. Hello, Sherry.
Hello.
Hi there. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I grew up in Centerville, and actually I graduated with Gary Craver, and a few years ago I worked at the State Historical Society in Iowa City and was in contact with Gary at that time. So we have very similar backgrounds, graduating in the same small class of 135 people, but my memories of it was a very safe, congenial town, and for sure some bigots, but we were really aware of the bootlegging issue.
So were there stories told about the bootleggers during Prohibition?
Oh, yes. We always heard that there was a connection with Al Capone. Now, for me, that had never been verified. But I do remember going out of town. I think it was north on Highway 6, and my dad would take me to a gentleman's house with him, and he would buy liquor there.
Well, so, Al Capone was in Centerville. I have got 3 positive identifications of him.
Oh.
And what you will love is that the first gentleman that opened up to me was extremely nervous. And he said, I understand you are sourcing everything in that book. I said, yes, I'm a fanatic about accuracy. I'm sourcing everything. He says, I don't want my name. So I said, now he was in his 90s, by the way, when he said this. So he opened up and he told me how he had seen Al Capone in town when he was a little boy. He described the scar on the side of his face, etc. Right. And later I went to speak to another wonderful woman in Centerville up in her 80s, and she gave me another sighting of Al Capone in great detail. And I said to her nervously, do you want your name to be in the sources? And she said, of course I want my name in the sources, and my brother's, and my sister. So it was just an entirely different approach to knowing about Al Capone. Al Capone was active in the town, and so this Fred Burke was a very nasty piece of work, and I couldn't believe it when I discovered that he actually got married in Centerville under the false name of Richard F. White.
Wow. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for your
call. Yes, thank you, Sherry.
And, of course, we were talking about the Ku Klux Klan as well. Miriam in Cedar Rapids has some family memories of that. Hello, Miriam.
Hello there. My mother-in-law lived in Centerville. Her folks moved there in the late 1890s. She was the oldest of Francis and Frank Cernich. They had a farm. Frank was well thought of by the other farmers because he was almost like an amateur veterinarian. Those same people, the Ku Klux Klan, put burning crosses on their lawn, and they felt it was some of their neighbors. My mother-in-law says she ran up and pulled the sheet off one of them, and it was one of the boys she knew from town.
Yes. You know, Miriam, I didn't catch your father's last name, the amateur vet.
Cernich. He was actually a farmer, Frank and Francis Cernich, C-E-R-N-I-C-H.
I got
their
it.
Youngest daughter, Bertha Cernich, taught as a teacher in Centerville all her life, and she died in her 90s.
Wonderful. When did you move away from Centerville, Miriam?
This is my mother-in-law's family. My mother-in-law came to Chicago in about 1923 or 4, but the family stayed there. My Bertha Cernich lived with her mother, Frances Cernich, in town, and they both died in Centerville.
Oh, okay. I will look them up when I get home.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Well, Miriam, thank you so much for the call. And did you do a lot of interviewing, Enfys? I know you spent a lot of time reading all those old newspapers and looking at the historical records. Did you also try to, this is old history, so a lot of people, of course, weren't able to share their living memories of it, but did you do a lot of interviews like the ones you did about Al Capone?
Yes, absolutely. Anybody that would, they knew, they all know what I was doing, and anybody that would call me and say, look, I got a story, I was there in a heartbeat, and would continue to do it in future. In the Second World War, now remember, I remember those soldiers in the Second World War, and when the veterans of the Second World War don't want to tell their stories, they always feel that the real heroes were the people that were left on the battlefield. But one of the veterans, a man by the name of Rhys Hudson, was the first one to open up to me. And he started nudging the other veterans to start telling me their stories. And the stories I encountered were just enough to make you sit there and weep what those boys had to go through, you know.
Wow. Let's get back to the phones. BJ is on the line in North Liberty. Hi, BJ.
Hi, it's me, BJ, from 1988 at school. And I wanted to let you know, Enfys, that the man I was married to, his father was in a great bluegrass band from the whole region there during Prohibition. And I just recently found out the reason they played bluegrass. They were dealing and bootlegging alcohol from the state.
You know, BJ, if you contact, and this is true for Miriam as well, and even Sherry with any memories that she's got, if you contact me via the Appanoose Historical Society, I will go and examine and find out what I can find about your family backgrounds, because that's a wonderful story about the bluegrass.
Yes, thank you so much. And you were my very favorite teacher here.
Right. Oh, I paid people to say that, Miriam.
I miss you, Anne Fitz.
All right, darling.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, BJ. And next, let's go to Greg on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Greg.
Well, hi. I have a question because I'm related to Vera Elgin. And I know you know about Vera.
Yes.
Well, and for those of us who don't, can one of you enlighten us?
Do you want to enlighten us, Greg?
Well, I know her youngest brother, Sherman.
Yes. He was a veteran in the Second World War. And by the way, he has asked me to go with the veterans on the next trip that they're going to make to Washington to see the memorial there.
Yes.
And that'll be wonderful. But Sherman has told me a bit. Vera, for those of you wondering who Vera was, she was incredibly beautiful. And she became a cover girl, a very famous, prominent cover girl right through the end of the 20s, the 30s. Not far into the 40s, though, Greg, right?
Right.
What do you know about her?
Well, Vera was... For many years, she was in New York City.
That's right.
And she actually drowned in one of the New York City's rivers.
Yes, East River, I understand, right?
The East River.
Right.
Okay, and I think that's right around 1952.
That's right. It was your Uncle Sherman that told me about the end of her life. Now, she was married to a French duke at some stage, and her extraordinary physical beauty and her face in particular graced so many magazines. People were buying the magazines from Allen's bookstore right on Centerville Square just so that they could have a copy and say they knew her.
Oh, Greg, thank you so much for calling so many remarkable individuals from such a small community. Wayne is on the line next from West Des Moines. Hi, Wayne.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was just wondering if you were familiar with the fact that Centerville played a large part of a play called The Rhymers of Eldridge, which premiered in New York in the mid-60s, had a very successful run, and has been subsequently produced around the country quite regularly. In fact, Waukee High School Theater Arts presented it a couple years ago. It's referenced quite a bit. I believe the playwright is Lanford Wilson, or it could be Langston Hughes. I'm not sure which right now.
I think Langston Hughes was a poet. So the first name you gave, but Wayne, I didn't catch the full name of the play. I don't know about it, and I'd love to know about it. So if you give me the title of that play again, please.
It's called The Rhymers, R-I-M-E-R-S, of Eldridge. And Eldridge was supposed to be a town in Missouri, and they referred to going to the city of Centerville, or they even referenced Des Moines.
For goodness sake. Well, no, I didn't know about it. And again, anything you can give me a lead where I can read more about that. You see, I finished the story in 1946. And a lot of people have urged me to go beyond. But as Charity said in the beginning of the program, it's got 500 pages in it already and nearly 7,000 sources, so that people, if they wish to query my accuracy, they can go to the actual article. So at some stage or other, I had to say stop. And people have urged me to go beyond and to bring it right up to date. I think I'm nervous to do it because I wouldn't feel quite as free about, I wouldn't want to upset families in the town that might not have a stellar record like most of the people in the town, if you see what I mean. But I'd love to know more about that. Give me a source if you can, Wayne, and I'd love to know more. Again, the Historical Society in Centerville, just contact them and they'll let me know.
All right. And I did just look it up. Rhymers of Eldritch is a play by Lanford Wilson.
Lanford Wilson. Got
yes.
it.
And we are nearly out of time, so I'm afraid we're not going to be able to go to any more calls. But I am curious. This story, it does show us some remarkable things about Centerville, some amazing, wonderful things about the community, but the
yes.
dark side as well. You write about the murders. You write about violence. You write, of course, about the Ku Klux Klan taking
yes.
over the community in many ways. And although the community did rise up and throw them out, I can imagine that some people don't want this history to be talked about. What kind of responses have you gotten from residents of Centerville?
Really positive. They wanted to know. A couple of people didn't want to be quoted in the sources. So I said, no problem, name withheld. They told me of hidden events. For example, one boy went upstairs into an attic. He dug out a big trunk and found one of these gowns, didn't know what it was, came waltzing downstairs in it, and his grandparents almost had a heart attack and swore him to secrecy. So there was a lot. Another man, wonderful man, called Bill Smallwood from Mystic. He's a professional writer out west. And he said he grew up in Mystic in the 1930s, the 1940s, and he said, I never, never, never heard a single word that you've written in those five chapters, because I've got five chapters on the KKK.
Wow. So this wasn't history that people were talking about.
And you know what happens is that the bigots die, you know? They die off, and then the new generation. And when I was a teacher in Indian Hills Community College, I taught there for 26 years. I could see the complete change. This generation won't have anything to do with that racial bigot stuff.
Fascinating. And so in telling this history, is that being welcomed by the community?
Oh, absolutely. I'm queen of the May down there, to tell you the truth.
So you spent over a decade researching
yes.
for this book. What's next?
Our good thought. Well, first of all, Governor Drake had a granddaughter that I'm trying to track her down, what happened to her. I don't think have we have enough time for me to tell you that?
In about 25 seconds, if you
oh,
can.
Oh, we don't.
Okay.
Then I'm trying to track her history. And then I'm trying to do a novel next about Victorian England. And the story has gone through my mind 1,000 times over the last 40 years, and I would like to give birth to that novel.
So now that you have dug out all this history about Centerville, it sounds like you're not going to be able to stop, though. So many people were calling and sharing stories and giving you
Isn't
leads
that the
today.
Truth?
So
and
do you
I
follow
will,
up on everything?
I will follow every detail. They got my word.
All right. Enfys, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was lovely being interviewed by you, Charity.
Enfys McMurray is the author of Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. She taught for many years at Indian Hills Community College in Centerville and spent more than a decade researching the history of this remarkable community. Again, Centerville, a Mid-American Saga. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Support today from John Pemble, and with me now, Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up today at noon, Ben?
Charity, it's Wednesday. That means it's Politics Day. And last night, many Iowans gathered for caucuses, not to weigh in on the party nominations for the U.S. president, as we will in 2016 and did in 2012. Last night was about determining who will control the GOP in Iowa and the Democratic Party. We'll talk about get analysis from Dennis Goldford at Drake University on the program, as well as Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. So that's kind of interesting, an off-year caucus, what actually happens, how that pertains to shaping the race for the nomination in 2016. So we hope you'll join with your ears and also call up with questions about it
right.
over the noon hour, Charity.
And, of course, it's never too soon to start thinking about the next caucus, right?
It's Iowa, Charity. It's Iowa. We love politics.
All right. That's River to River today at noon. Coming up tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to talk about the orchestras of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.